Modern smartphones are sleek and thin, but they're also fragile and expensive. If you're really careful, you may use it until you're ready to upgrade without shattering the glass. But if you look around, you'll see most phones wrapped in a case for protection. Our personal data is even more valuable than the device it's stored on, and it deserves just as much protection. The work that I do requires me to travel a lot, which means I'm frequently connected to unfamiliar networks. Nefarious hackers can make up to $1,000 selling the data of each of their victims on the dark web, and there are cheap hardware and software tools readily available that let even a smart middle schooler snatch your data without you even noticing. A virtual private network, or VPN, like ExpressVPN, creates a secure, encrypted tunnel between your devices and the servers that you're transmitting data to and from. When you're sitting at the airport gate area, or airline lounge, or even your hotel room, those Wi-Fi networks aren't secure. Your bits are flying through the air, and whether you're checking your bank account balance, sending data to a client, or just checking your email, bad actors can snatch up your usernames, passwords, and everything else you send and receive if it's not encrypted. The layers of security used by ExpressVPN would take over a billion years to expose by bad guys with some of the most powerful supercomputers. ExpressVPN trusted server technology also runs each session in memory in a unique virtual space that is wiped clean as you end your session, with none of your data ever written to a hard drive, so there's no residue for anyone to recover about what you were doing after the fact. ExpressVPN runs on almost all devices, including Windows, Mac, iOS, Linux, Android, streaming devices like Chromecast, Roku, Fire Stick, and Apple TV, and there's also a Chrome browser extension. It's super simple to use. Once you install ExpressVPN, it's one click to establish a secure encrypted tunnel with servers in 105 countries around the world. I've personally been paying for and using ExpressVPN for years on all of my personal devices. When I first started using VPNs for work more than 20 years ago, they were often slow and unstable and had to be restarted frequently. But with ExpressVPN, data speeds are virtually unchanged from running fully exposed, so you can just turn the VPN on and leave it on. I often get materials from clients and companies that are under embargo or NDA, and if it leaks out, I can get into some trouble. But even if I just wanted to reach back to my personal server to grab some files, check my email, or watch something that's only available on one of my streaming services at home while I'm out of the country, ExpressVPN lets me do it all securely. Your data is valuable. Don't let bad actors steal it and potentially misuse it. Secure your online data today by visiting expressvpn.com/wheelbearings. That's expressvpn.com/wheelbearings. And you can get an extra 3 months free when you sign up. Expressvpn.com/wheelbearings. And thanks to ExpressVPN for supporting Wheelbearings.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to episode 157 of Wheel Bearings. I'm Sam Abul Samet from Guidehouse Insights.
I'm Rebecca Linland from Rebecca Drives.
And Dan is off actually trying to make a living today, so he's unavailable to join us. He's got some projects that he's running up against a deadline on, so it's just the two of us today. So Rebecca, what have you been driving?
So I have been driving the 2021 Kia Seltos. It's kind of this small, almost SUV. They market it as an SUV, but it's actually a size of vehicle that I really like. You can fit four comfortably in it, five if you're, you know, running errands or going to lunch or something when we are allowed to go to lunch again with our colleagues. And, you know, it has a nice ground clearance, you know, nothing crazy. I'm really fond of this size of vehicle. I think it's practical for a lot of households. So the Kia Seltos, it starts at $21,990. They've got about $1,120 of destination charge on it. It's interesting because the Mulroney that came with my media car didn't match my experience. And it started from the very beginning when I couldn't get the door open with the supposedly standard keyless entry. So this car didn't have keyless entry. It didn't have push button start. It didn't have automatic air. And it's funny because I get so used to those things. And I think we get so used to those things.
We're spoiled. That
very, very spoiled. But I will say for, and I guess I apply this mostly to women, but you know, when, because I drop my key in my handbag and I don't even think about it, but you know, I do, I mean, my own car, Coco, doesn't have keyless entry. And I will say from a safety standpoint, like when I got home late from airports and you're walking to my car, it is important, I think, particularly for women, that you do invest in keyless entry when you're shopping for a car. Whether it's used or new, it doesn't matter. The idea that you're not fumbling for your car keys as you're walking up to a car, really in any situation, I think is important. And I think that that's one thing that, you know, if a lot of people, you know, as we've talked about before, cars are 10, 11 years old. You may not realize, you know, if you've never had keyless entry, you don't realize how convenient it can be. But for me, it was also a safety issue of not being distracted when you're walking up to your car, you know, being able to just go up, get in, and lock the doors right away. There's just that feeling of, you know, it's one less thing to distract you from getting into your car safely. Mm-hmm. So I will tell, you know, and particularly the women out there, that I would look at keyless entry as something that is, I would consider essential in when you're shopping for a new or gently used car. And the other thing that I'm very, very spoiled because I love auto air, and it seems to be still misunderstood. So auto air is, you know, you can just set it and forget it. And I love that. So my preferred temperature is 70 degrees. And I, you know, the good systems don't blast you with super hot air in the summer and freezing cold air in the winter. It will warm up in a separate location, you know, within the engine and then start feeding more appropriately temperatured air into your cabin. But I like the fact that you can just set it, forget it, and it's one less thing to worry about. So again, not having it was something that, you know, I had to kind of fumble with it and get used to it. This didn't even have the temperature dial. I mean, it only had a dial. It didn't have the actual specific temperature.
So just from blue to red.
Yeah, exactly. From blue to red. Right. So it was really old school, which again was good for me, you know, to experience. It did have a lot of safety features on it. It did have, you know, the blind spot collision warning, rear cross traffic alert, things like that. So there were, you know, it was kind of a hodgepodge of things that it did have, you know, in terms of new technology. Overall, the driving experience was excellent. I actually had to go down to JFK to pick up my sister, which was a good, you know, 45 miles from my house. So I got some good driving in with it. Road noise was pretty minimal. You know, cabin comfort was nice. It doesn't have, you have to either use Apple CarPlay or Android Auto. And that worked, Android Auto worked pretty well for me, so I didn't have any issues
Does
with
it
that.
Also have the standard Hyundai Kia interface on the screen as well? Like just, you know, just for the radio? I mean, no nav, obviously, but...
Right. It just had the radio, just the black and white screen with the radio on it.
Okay.
Yes. And voice control worked pretty well, too, once I had, you know, Android Auto activated. And even without it, I was able to change the radio station and things like that. So, you know, again, it's funny to not have a map that even shows up, you know, something like that. But it was overall, you know, the infotainment system was totally adequate for the job. And again, the Android Auto worked really, really well and pretty seamlessly. And I would assume that Apple CarPlay would do the same. It was comfortable. I mean, this thing is, you know, again, $22,000. It's for that price, I think it was really, really competitive within the segment. I do think, you know, the sticker that I had, the what's supposed to be the S turbo, you're starting to get into that 26, 27, 28 range. And I always just go to the fact of like, okay, what else can you get for that price? And, you know, I think about things like the Hyundai Venue that I really, really liked a lot. And I think these are very, very similar to it. So, you know, shop both of those vehicles when you go and look at these things, because I do think that, you know, there's a lot as you start to get into that 27, 28, 29 price range, you can get a lot of different things.
Yeah, I was just looking at the specs. And, you know, when we first saw the Seltos, I think it was at the LA Auto Show where they unveiled it last November, which seems like a million years ago now. But, you know, at the time, you know, I looked at it and, you know, my assumption was that, you know, because this was, you know, priced, you know, relatively low, you know, 21,000, I think was, you know, was the base price. That and talking to James Bell from Kia, you know, that this was based on, you know, that this was Kia's variant of the Venue.
Right.
But in fact, this is actually really a size class up from the Venue. It's quite a bit larger.
Funny? You know, it is quite a bit larger because I did feel that. Go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah. You know, I just pulled up, you know, comparing the specs. This thing is almost 13 inches longer than a Venue. So it's more than a foot longer than a Venue. And the wheelbase is like 4 inches longer than the Venue. So it's a quite a bit larger vehicle. And, you know, so it makes sense that it's obviously going to be a little more expensive than the Venue. And, you know, the Venue doesn't offer things like a turbocharged engine option. You know, you only have one powertrain option in the Venue.
Right.
Everything's kept fairly simple.
It is. I mean, and I definitely did feel like this was a little bit larger vehicle than the Venue, because a neighbor down the street that, and I drive by their driveway, which is pretty close to the road, and I can, they have one of those cool, like kind of China gray colored Venues there. Mm-hmm. And so I would sort of look at it and compare. And I think the Venue sits lower also. The ground clearance on the Seltos is just over 7 inches. And you can definitely see that also. You know, again, I think it's a good solid vehicle. I'd love to drive one with all of the accoutrements and kind of get that the full luxury, quote luxury, you know, the full fully optioned out experience in it. But, you know, again, like once I was in it and once I had the temperature, right. it was a good experience overall. I think it's definitely a vehicle that deserves to be test driven, deserves to, you know, be in that comparison shopping when you go. I also just, you know, Kia is just doing a lot of things really, really well, and like Hyundai as well. And so I think, you know, it's just a good product overall. It was solidly built, no rattles, you know, all the switches and the buttons and everything were intuitive, and the cloth, you know, the cloth seats were really nice. I mean, again, it was sort of this weird, you know, car that you can't buy, but from a spec standpoint, but from a overall driving experience. Oh, the other thing it didn't have was power seats. And so, you know, it was just sort of funny to be in a car like that. But it was a good experience though. Overall, I liked it.
Well, that's great. You know, going back to what you're talking about with the keyless entry, you know, fortunately, you know, almost all new vehicles have it now, you know, except for, you know, in some cases, the base models of some lower cost vehicles. But, you know, the vast majority, even, you know, even things like the Kia Rio, you know, except for the base trim level, you know, you've got keyless entry available. And you know, the specs for the Seltos indicate that it should be standard on there. So I think, you know, most likely, you know, this particular situation, a lot of times the cars that are in the press fleet are pre-production vehicles that are shipped over, and they're not necessarily exactly the right spec of what's going to go on sale. And so that's probably the case here. You know, I'm surprised that, you know, that they shipped over a car, you know, I mean, this is probably a car that was built, you know, maybe for another market, you know, but that they shipped over one that didn't have some of those features. But I agree with what you're saying, you know, the rationale for having keyless entry, you know, it is more than just a convenience feature. You know, in some cases it can actually be a real valid safety feature as well.
Right. And that's one thing also, that I want to emphasize to our listeners, is that when you are shopping, some of these things seem like almost like overkill. Like, oh, why would I need that? But you really, on those test drives, you've got to try out some of these features. Try out like rear cross traffic alert. I've spoken about this before. When you are in a parking lot, especially with SUVs, everyone has SUVs now. When you're trying to back out, having that rear cross traffic alert, having that pedestrian alert, things like that, that rear camera, that and those sensors that are picking up things that you can't see. Mm-hmm. So on that test drive, you know, It's funny because you always, you know, they have an assigned route and you're supposed to do this, that, and thing. No, I am all about take it in situations that you have, that you experience. If you have to parallel park regularly, parallel park that car when you're on a test drive. Because I'll tell you, one of the things that, again, like, you know, as somebody who sits closer, like the A-pillar, the width of the A-pillar is really important to me. And there's been times when visibility has been pretty compromised. If you drive that car on your regular route and do the things that you do in that car, it's worth spending the extra time. You're investing, you know, tens of thousands of dollars in this thing. Whether it's new or used, it doesn't matter. It's drive it in your experience, the way that you live it.
Yeah, no, totally agree. And, you know, that's what we try to do every week with the cars that we're driving is, yes, you know, use it the way normal people would. You know, I mean, obviously, we don't have access to test tracks. We don't go out and do instrumented testing with vehicles, you know, the way, you know, a Car and Driver or Motor Trend would do. But, you know, we're just trying to experience it to the degree that we can, you know, the way an average consumer would, and, you know, give that kind of feedback, you know, so hopefully, you know, provide something useful to the listeners.
Right. Exactly.
So, you know, what, you know, would you take this over the Venue, or, you know, or even, you know, like the Kia Sportage, or, you know, other options, you know? So this is really, you know, based on the size of this vehicle, it's really more in the compact rather than kind of in between compact and subcompact in terms of size. It's 172 inches long. So it's a little bit smaller than, you know, like a CR-V or Escape or RAV4.
Yeah. So I think it depends on your household and your budget. I think that, you know, when I think about vehicles like the Buick Encore GX, which was $4,000-$6,000 more than the top of the line Seltos, but man, that thing was super, super nice. I think that, you know, it depends on your budget. If you are maxed out at $25,000, then I think this is a good option. And also think, keep in mind too, you know, look in that price range, what can you get on the used car market, you know, versus the new car market? So I think that it's definitely worth a test drive, but it's also worth trying other size vehicles. I liked this size. I don't, you know, I was trying to, the fuel economy is rated at 25 up to 30 with 27. So, you know, one of the competitors that comes up too is the Subaru Crosstrek, which I think is a really, really good vehicle as well. So, you know, so they're listing the Hyundai Kona as the competitor, which I think I had the Kona last year rather than the Venue. Yeah, I mean, I think it's, again, I like the styling of it a lot also. So, you know, there's, as we've talked about before, there's not a lot of bad cars out there. I think that I would definitely look at the Crosstrek for sure. I wasn't crazy about the Honda HR-V. I haven't had it for about a year and a half, probably 2 years now, but I remember it being fairly tinny and, mm-hmm. and not, a, you know, there's, Honda's always tend to, I should say, they often will have a pretty loud road noise. And that was not the case that I felt with the Kia Seltos. The other thing too, that you mentioned is the infotainment system. You have to see which infotainment system is easy for you, is ergonomically friendly for you, is intuitive, makes sense. You're not fighting with it all the time. You know, so again, these are kind of some of the things that I would look at when you're testing the Seltos against things like the Kona, the Crosstrek, and the HR-V.
Yeah. And you know, absolutely. You know, when you're going to do a test drive, you know, you're probably going to have your phone with you, but you know, take a USB cable with you and, you know, plug in your phone and see what it's like to actually pair it, go through that whole process, you know, see what it's like to use, you know, your phone with that vehicle, you know, what that experience is like.
Exactly. I mean, the Sportage is is larger than this and gives you more of that SUV feeling, you know, in my mind. But yeah, no, you've got to test these things with your phone, with your lifestyle. What is it to load and unload? You know, I liked the fact that with that only 7-inch ground clearance, you can get heavy items into the back easier. All that kind of stuff just plays into whether you're going to be happy. These sort of emotional solutions, as I've called them, you know, how is it to live with?
Yeah, you're right. The Sportage is about 4.5 inches longer than this one. So, you know, it's kind of this step, you know, as you go, you know, the Venue is 159 inches long. The Kona is 164. Then the Seltos is 172 and then 176.5 for the Sportage. So it's kind of, you know, somewhere in there, there's one that's going to fit your lifestyle.
It's a Goldilocks thing.
Yep, exactly. All right.
So you were in a much fancier vehicle than I was.
a little bit fancier, a little bit more expensive.
But I've driven this one as well.
But it had a turbocharged 4-cylinder engine. It was a compact crossover. So, you know, same thing, right?
Yeah, same thing, right. Yeah.
Now, I had the BMW X3 xDrive 30e, you know, yet another example of BMW's cumbersome naming strategy. So this is the latest, it's the plug-in hybrid variant of the X3. Unfortunately, BMW has opted not to offer the new iX3, which is their full battery electric version, in the US, for the time being. I think most likely because they probably took a look at, you know, Audi and Jaguar and realized that the iX3 is probably not going to have enough range to really be competitive at their price point. And so they're waiting until the next generation, or actually waiting till the iNext, you know, which is a dedicated EV rather than conversion, comes out next year.
Right.
But the 30E is the plug-in hybrid version. So like most of BMW's other plug-in hybrids, it uses their 2-liter turbo 4-cylinder. And there's an electric motor sandwiched between the engine and the transmission, 8-speed automatic transmission. In this case, it's all-wheel drive as well. It has a range, all-electric driving range, officially rated at 18 miles. I went and, you know, went for a drive, you know, had it fully charged up, drove around through a variety of conditions, you know, urban, suburban, highway conditions. I actually got 23 miles of range out of it before the engine came on and stayed on in regular hybrid mode.
Wow, that's awesome. I don't think I got that. I think I got maybe 20. I did get more than 18 though, but yeah, okay. So that's really, really good.
Yeah, it is, you know, which, you know, Nothing wrong with that. You know, and the X3 is a nice vehicle. It's got a really nice interior, drives well. You know, this is basically, you know, think of it, you know, like an elevated 3-series hatchback, you know, wagon. So, you know, it's not, I wouldn't really call it a full-blown SUV, but, you know, neither is BMW. To BMW, these are sport activity vehicles. They don't make sport utility vehicles. but, you know, there's plenty of cargo space in the back. You know, we took it to go to the lake on a Saturday morning and, you know, had the inflatable paddleboard and a couple of beach chairs and assorted other detritus in the back. Daisy and our daughter Sophie in the back seat. So there was, you know, plenty of room inside. It's comfortable to drive. I said gets, you know, really good fuel efficiency. Even when you get into hybrid mode, after the battery's been depleted, you're still getting, you know, 35 to 40 miles per gallon, which I think is really good for a vehicle of this type. It's got plenty of performance, 282 horsepower combined from the engine and the electric motor. And even when you're in electric drive mode, there's plenty of performance, you know, as long as you're not, you know, shotgunning it, you know, you've got different drive modes to choose from. There's an eco mode, there's comfort mode, sport mode. In, you know, comfort mode or eco mode, you know, you can, accelerate at reasonable speeds, you know, so you're not sitting there trying to feather the accelerator. You know, it will actually, you know, it shows you on the gauge, you know, the limit of where, you know, where if you go beyond this, it's going to turn on the engine. And, you know, it'll actually try to, you know, as long as you're not, you know, really getting hard onto the accelerator, it will basically try to keep it near, right near that limit and keep it in electric mode. You know, so that's nice. You know, so you can, it's really easy to drive around electrically. So the, you know, the reality is most people can do most of their driving, you know, most of their, you know, they're driving around, you know, if schools were open and you could actually take your kids to school and drop them off and pick them up and, you know, do your shopping, you could do all that sort of thing without using any gas in this thing. The one that I had, had the M Sport package on it and assorted other, options, you know, so the base price starts at like $48,000. So it's, you know, it's not inexpensive. It's fairly pricey, but, you know, it's, for a BMW, it's actually not totally unreasonable. I am this week driving another BMW that we'll talk about next time that is not as nice as this and cost $50,000. So we'll come back to that one next time. The one that I had, it didn't come with a Monroney, but building one as close as I could on the BMW website, it came to just about $60,000 delivered. So, you know, it's a fairly pricey vehicle, but, you know, it's a BMW. So you get what you get, you know, so nice interior, really nice seats. The M Sport package, you know, comes with nice sport seats and, including, you know, adjustable thigh supports, all that sort of stuff, all the driver assist systems. So you got adaptive cruise control and lane keeping assist and, actually lane centering. So it's good. You know, I was impressed with it. I like driving it. And I generally, I've always liked, driving BMW's plug-in hybrids, ever since, I think probably about 3 years ago that I first drove the 7 Series plug-in hybrid with basically the same powertrain in it. And, you know, it's really smooth and seamless and quiet. You know, when it does transition from electric mode to hybrid mode, the engine starts up, you don't feel it at all. I mean, it's really just transitions. The only thing is if you listen carefully, you'll hear the engine come on, but you won't feel anything at all. So it's great in that respect. You know, if you're wanting to go at least partially electric, but you're not quite ready to make the jump to a full battery electric vehicle, and you want something premium, you know, I mean, there are obviously other options, you know, at lower price points, but if you want something, you know, that feels premium and gives you that ability to do a lot of your driving electrically, this is definitely one worthy of consideration.
Yeah, I really liked it. It sounds like we had a very, very similar experience and a similar vehicle, because looking at mine did have a sticker with it. It started at $49,545, and that includes the $995 destination. And then as tested was $60,545. So I think it's very, very similar. It's
probably the same spec. Yeah.
Right. I got 34.7 miles per gallon. And that was including 65 miles of driving in EV mode only. And, you know, just, I had a really, really good experience. I talked about it a couple of episodes ago, but I think you're right. I think that it's a good option of that. If you want a plug-in electric without going full battery electric, I think this is a really good small family car. You know, it was quite roomy, very, very comfortable. I've had BMWs for a long time, so for me, it was. I compared to, you know, putting on my favorite slippers, because I just got in and I was like, oh,
well, you owned an X3 before, right?
I did. I had two X3s and then I moved to the X5, which was way too big for me. Yeah. But yeah. So, and it's funny because that was 10 years ago now that I had, I think my X5 was a 2011. And it's funny because now, you know, to your first point of their naming conventions, they have X2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Like, I definitely could have found one in the middle. I probably would have gotten an X4 and still been in the brand, because I ended up getting rid of the X5 because it was just too big. But, you know, I do think that this is a great a great vehicle for if you've got the type of lifestyle that you're doing a lot of in-town errands, you know, or like even the new lifestyle of working from home and just needing to get out every once in a while, you can do an awful lot of that in EV mode. I am looking at getting a high-speed charger installed in the house because the trickle charging was painful, 14 hours, you know, to get about 20 miles. So, you know, again, it doesn't matter if it's just sitting there, whatever. It doesn't matter then. Now, I did just lose power for 5 days in the tropical storm that we had this week. So obviously that would be sub-op. And that's, again, to your point.
That's also an advantage of a plug-in hybrid.
Versus exactly. Battery to your point of, you know, that's why having that dual fuel option is really, really good because you're not going to get in a jam, you know? So I think that I like this idea. I like that combination of being able to have EV mode when you want it and when you can use it and then just gasoline. So I like this car a lot.
Yeah.
All right. Oh, you know, the other thing too, a couple of points that I made earlier, I think I loved the infotainment system and the heads up display in this. It was really, really good. I think that gesture control is a total waste of money. I just have to reinforce that.
I would definitely agree with that. It's a total gimmick. I mean,
really, I just end up giving it the finger.
When I'm twirling my finger around 2 inches away from the knob to just, I could just twist exactly. And do that knob with far more precision. Yeah. I'm curious to see when BMW finally gives up on the gesture control.
Right. Yeah. Move on. Yeah.
Anyway. All right. So let's get into some of the news of the past week.
Yes.
We had a little announcement from Ford last week. You want to talk about that?
Was that, you mean Jim? Which Jim?
Yeah. Jim. And Jim. Yes.
Jim and Jim. So yeah, so Ford is transitioning from the Jim Hackett three-ish year era to the Jim Farley era, which I think that will be a really interesting transition for them. You know, Keith Naughton from Bloomberg, he tweeted out something like, this is his eighth Ford CEO. And one of the things that I feel like needs to be conveyed, you know, Jim Farley's been there for 13 years. And I think he's the obvious transition after Heinrichs was unceremoniously released. But I think that Jim really, I would love to see him convey that. Why is he the right person? What is he going to be doing? How is he going to be doing it differently or motivating the culture of Ford and motivating the stock price, frankly? I think that that is one of his biggest tasks, is to show Wall Street why he's the right guy and why it's going to be different this time. And, you know, Mark Fields was let go because one of the reasons was the stock price was abysmal. And under Hackett, the stock price fell even more. And
well, you know, there were a lot of other reasons why Mark Fields.
I realized there was internal reasons why Mark Fields was let go. There's external reasons of the stock price, but you know, the external measure of that is the stock price. And so I think, you know, conveying to Wall Street and the industry is something, the message of what the Farley years are going to look like, I think is really critical.
Yeah. And, you know, I've developed a lot of respect for Jim Hackett over the last couple of years, you know, watching closely, you know, what Ford's been doing. And, you know, there's things that I've seen that I'm not at liberty to talk about, but, you know, I think that he has put them on the right path. To his credit, I think he's done a lot of good for Ford over the last 3 years, but you know, his personality and, you know, he's, let's just say he's not the most dynamic person out there.
Right.
You know, I think he's the kind of person that with the people that he works with directly internally, I think he's good at giving them, you know, the direction and the vision and, you know, getting them, you know, to do their jobs, doing what they need to do to succeed. But I think he's not the kind of out there person that's going to inspire, investors and especially retail investors. You know, he's clearly no Elon Musk.
Right.
Thankfully, there is no one else like that either. I think Jim Farley, as you and I, we've seen him speak many times, publicly. We've spoken to him privately as well. And he is, I think he's the kind of person who can definitely put a face on Ford that will be more inspiring to outsiders. He's able to articulate the story of what he wants to do and why are they doing what they're doing.
Right.
So I think he's probably a better communicator, especially an external communicator than Hackett. Yeah. From what I've seen, he and Hackett were very much on the same page as far as the direction they wanted to take the company. So I don't expect to see any notable changes in the direction for Ford over the next several years, but just, maybe more, maybe a better job of articulating what that vision is. And I think a big part of that is going to come with, seeing the products that are going to be coming out over the next 12 to 24 months.
Right.
Because ultimately that's what it comes down to, is what is the company actually selling?
Right.
And if they can execute on the product plan, and get vehicles like the new F-150, the Mach-E, the Bronco, and other stuff that's yet to be shown, on sale, get them built correctly, avoid the kind of fiasco they had with the Explorer last year, then I think that will really inspire a lot more confidence in Ford. And then, going forward, as they move into the mobility realm and get their automated driving program commercialized, getting more of the electric vehicles, especially the electric F-150 and the Transit. I think those two, those aren't the electric F-150 and the Transit are not the sexy products. I mean, that's the Mach-E. But I think from a business standpoint, those are actually far more important to Ford than the Mach-E will be, both in terms of volume, but also in terms of the kinds of customers that are going to buy those, that want those and need that type of vehicle. And, when I interviewed Jim Farley last fall, and I'll put a link to that recording in the show notes, one of the things he talked about quite a bit there, was Ford's strength in commercial vehicles. They understand the commercial vehicle market. And from a business perspective, people look at Ford and they get excited by Mustang, but it's selling Super Duties and F-150s and Transits to commercial customers. That's what makes the money. That's what makes the Mustang.
The bottom line, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's what makes the Mustang possible.
Yeah, for sure.
And so I think, when they get those vehicles into the marketplace, I think it'll show that, Ford can really produce, electric vehicles that also play to their strength, in the commercial sector. So,
yeah, no, I think so too. And, I think that Jim is authentic. I think he's believable. And not to say that Hackett isn't, but as you said, he's a very, very different type of personality. And I think that, I like Jim's global background as well. He's had experience overseas. And I agree. I think that he's been behind the scenes pushing a lot of what they've been doing on that product side. And, sitting down with him, he's believable, he's likable, he's responsive. And, I'd love to see him, in meetings, with a lot of, small group meetings and such, with people. I think the dealers like him as well. And that's important. And I think they can get excited. It's funny because when I realized he was 58, he looks like he's 40. I mean, he looks like he's exactly the same as he was when he joined the company, which is impressive from all the stress that he's had, that they all have. But, I think that he's a little bit of like a kid in a candy store. And that's can be a very appealing trait to be able to convey the passion and excitement and authenticity that is necessary to execute on plans like they do have. Because I totally agree. I think from a product standpoint, they've done a lot of good things. And also from, you know, Lincoln, of course, has been revitalized as well. And while Kumar Galhotra was one of the key operators of that, and he's been promoted as well, I do think that that is, again, part of that whole realm of senior leadership within Ford of understanding who's in the marketplace and what it takes to buy. So it was speaking of Lincoln, last week, I think it was last Friday, we had a little small group session with Matthew McConaughey. and I have to say, so it was for National Relaxation Day or something stupid like that. And
well, if there's anybody that's going to relax you, it's Matthew McConaughey.
Right? But, you know, we didn't get to speak directly with him, but he was also very, very authentic. And one of the things that I really related to was he talked about his 88-year-old mother, and she didn't live with them, but he said in March we went and got her and brought her home to, you know, to live with us to go through COVID together and, you know, and to get through this pandemic. And that was something that I very much related to because I'm dealing with the same, you know, my mom is 86 and she's living with my sister but it was one of the first things that he talked about and what his family is going through and stuff. And it was just, it was very, very real and very relatable and very down to earth. And he was incredibly encouraging to, there was another woman that was on that was a behavioral psychologist specialist, and she lives by herself and, you know, was talking about kind of trying to keep her spirits up and stuff. And he was so encouraging, and it was a really, you know, again, like those stupid commercials that I don't think do him justice. I think that his personality and he came out more authentic. And those commercials, I think you always have to kind of take them a little tongue in cheek. When I first got to Kelley Blue Book back in 2015, we started doing something called the Matthew Meter to see how the response was and who was actually shopping the Lincoln site. And I will tell you that there was a measurable difference in terms of income and education level of who was shopping the Lincoln brand after the commercials started airing. So I think he's been really good for the brand as well, but it was definitely very interesting. And really, I grew to have a more of an appreciation for him as an actor. I think he's amazing. He's, you know, just done incredible things, but, as a person, I think that it was cool to see him on for, you know, the hour and change that we had with him.
That's good.
Yeah. It was
all great. Right. So let's stick with Detroit for the next one. Yes. The Cadillac Lyric finally got its public reveal last Thursday night. It was originally supposed to be shown back in April. We were supposed to go to LA to see it. We saw it in March at the GM Design Dome. That was the last time any of us saw each other in person.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, then they obviously canceled that, and they did an online reveal on Thursday. What do you, you know, now that the world has seen the Lyric, you know, what are your thoughts?
So frankly, I didn't have power yet. Okay. And I have not backtracked to watching the reveal itself, but you know, my thoughts on it, I think that it's, you know, that type of vehicle is the right type of vehicle for an EV market. I think it needs to be luxurious. I think it needs to be nice. You know, it's kind of that stunning, smooth, elegant SUV that I think is appropriate for an EV market. So I wasn't, you know, I think it was a little bit funky looking back in March, which does seem like a lifetime ago. But, you know, I think that this is the type of product that could move people to Cadillac if they believe that Cadillac can produce the same kind of technology that Tesla does, because that's really who they're competing with.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, you know, Tesla is their, that's their target with this vehicle. You know, and it's, I think I love the design. You know, I think what they've done with the design of this, you know, taking, you know, going to the next generation of Cadillac design, you know, it's got some echoes of, you know, where we are today with their current generation of design language, but it's something that is even more contemporary and, you know, sets the electric Cadillacs apart from the what they have today.
Yes, very much so.
And the interior is just fabulous on this thing. You know, that 33-inch display panel, you know, one solid display all the way across.
It reminds me of the Porsche Taycan.
Yeah, except the Taycan's actually several separate pieces.
Right. This, you know, was all one.
Where it's just one seamless display all the way across from the A-pillar all the way across the center stack. And, you know, I think, you know, the design is great. You know, I was at a luncheon, a Cadillac luncheon back in December with Steve Carlisle and others from Cadillac. And he talked at the time about what they were planning to do with, you know, with their electric vehicles. And one of the things that Carlisle said at the time, Steve Carlisle is the president of Cadillac. He said that, you know, 300 miles is table stakes for a premium.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, absolutely.
You cannot go out with less than 300 miles.
You
and
can't,
they're targeting, you know, having 400 miles available.
Yeah. And, that's impressive.
You know, they reiterated last week, you know, that they will have over 300 miles on all variants of the Lyric going forward. That's not an issue. So I'm not concerned about range. They didn't get into any specific specs on this. The one disappointment that I have is the timing.
I know. I feel like. I mean, they're definitely late to this party, but I would rather have them late and good, or ideally perfect, than toss something out that isn't ideal and isn't perfect. And due in 2022.
Late 2022.
Late. Well, that's, yeah. I mean, yes, a year to 18 months earlier would be great, but it's not. And it is what it is.
Yeah. You know, I mean, back in the fall of 2017, GM held an event where they announced that they were going to do 20 EVs by 2023. And so far, at least here in North America, they've added zero EVs to their lineup. And that's almost 3 years ago now.
Yeah.
You know, so it's, you know, it seems pretty clear, you know, the first one that's coming is the Hummer, which is going to be next fall, you know, fall of next year. You know, so it seems pretty clear that at the time that they made that announcement, that they really hadn't started work on any of these vehicles. I mean, obviously they were working on the technology, they're working on the batteries, the power electronics, the motors, but they hadn't actually started work on any of those 20 vehicles. Cause they showed an image, you know, of 20 vehicles with silks on them, but didn't actually show any of those vehicles at the time. So obviously they hadn't, you know, they had nothing at that point.
It's a bold move. It's a bold statement to make when you don't have much.
Well, and even the Lyric, you know, they made the original announcement and showed a rendering of it in January of 2019, more than a year and a half ago, when they unveiled the XT6, you know, during the process of that event, you know, Carlisle put up this render, this sketch, you know, on the screen, you know, saying this is going to be our first, you know, electric Cadillac. And he didn't give any indication of timing, except that it would be, you know, they had at that point, they were going through a cadence of, you know, a new product every 6 months. And he said, you know, after that current product cadence is done, then we'll be introducing this, you know, so that, you know, we were kind of expecting, okay, you know, sometime, you know, late 2021, maybe, you know, but it's going to be a full year beyond that. So that's the only unfortunate thing. But, you know, to what you said, you know, even in 2022, this market for EVs is still going to be a very small market. I mean, we're probably looking at no more than 3 or 4% of the market.
And that's like tripling it.
Yeah.
Because we're like 1% now.
Right. So, you know, it's not like they're, you know, going to be coming into a huge market at that point. It's, you know, it's still going to be a tiny market, but it would be nice if, you know, with all the GM has said about, you know, wanting to be a leader in EVs, wanting to go all electric, you know, if they were able to bring something out a little bit sooner than that.
Yeah.
But
no, when they, and I will be the first one to admit that I should know this, but I'm going to ask you anyway. When they talk about all electric, to our earlier conversation about PHEVs and the convenience of dual fuel or dual power, what are they really talking about here?
They mean all electric. Mark Royce has made it very clear in multiple
interviews. That's what I was afraid of. I was hoping GM, that I had misinterpreted.
GM is done with hybrids. They're not doing any more hybrids. In fact, they've discontinued all the hybrids they had.
So that's what I was afraid that I was hoping that I was misreading these things.
Nope.
But I wasn't.
So there is not going to be a plug-in hybrid Corvette, to anybody that was wondering about that. There's not going to be any other hybrid or plug-in hybrid vehicle from GM. You know, they discontinued the Volt. They dropped the Malibu hybrid. They discontinued the Cadillac CT6 plug-in hybrid that was sold here. You know, that they sold a few hundred of, I think. you know, they still have a couple of plug-in hybrids in China. But even those are ultimately going to be replaced with battery electric vehicles. So he said they're not doing any more hybrids going forward. It's all battery electric. That's it.
And what is the logic there?
You know, there obviously there are additional costs with doing a plug-in hybrid. It's, you know, overall, it's not as efficient as a battery electric vehicle. You know, you're carrying around an internal combustion powertrain and an electric powertrain. You know, so it's a compromised thing. And they've decided to, you know, make the investment. And, you know, they feel they got far enough along in battery development that they felt that they can get their battery costs down to a point where it's cost competitive and there's no point in doing a hybrid or plug-in hybrid anymore. They're just going to go all in on the batteries.
The thing is though, for me, it's the battery technology is absolutely critical, but the charging speed is the other part of that. I mean, that is the fork to the knife in this situation in my mind. You know, the only reason that range and range anxiety is a thing is because of charging time and access to stations. We all should have gas range anxiety because you run out at 300 miles, let's say, but we don't because it's familiar and gas stations are convenient and recharging.
There's 168,000 gas stations in the United States right now.
Exactly. And so the idea that, you know, that the battery technology, it's also about that recharging technology, the refueling aspect of it is just as critical to the success. I've said it before and I will say it again. We have to do a better job of conveying to the consumer why an EV is a better solution to their mobility than a gas-powered vehicle is. And right now, it doesn't look like it's more convenient to the consumer. It doesn't appear to be more convenient. It's not more convenient. And it's not better from the values that people have. You know, when you think about something like the iPhone or an iPad or you know, even a laptop. And I realize it's not 100%, you know, apples to apples, but no pun intended. Oh, that was a good one. But my point is that people were willing to adopt the technology of Apple because it was better. It wasn't technology they asked for, like Steve Jobs said, but it was better. It was perceived to be better, even if the reality wasn't there. And so I think we as an industry need to do a really good job of conveying to people why EVs are better. And that's why they should buy them. And it's not just about the environment, because people don't care enough.
Right. And, you know, to their credit, you know, automakers are starting to invest more in the charging side of it. This is something that,
yes, as we saw with GM.
Aside from Tesla, you know, they, until fairly recently, they've been reluctant to invest in the infrastructure side of it.
Well, they don't invest in gas stations, right?
Well, exactly. Yeah. You know, they never owned the liquid fuel infrastructure, and right, they felt that they didn't need to invest in the electric charging infrastructure.
Right.
Now they're seeing, you know, especially, you know, as they start to reach the point where, you know, they're no longer going to have the incentives, you know, tax incentives to get people to buy them, they have to find the other reasons to, to convince consumers to buy these vehicles. And, you know, so, you know, GM made their announcement with EVgo that, you know, they're going to put in a bunch of DC fast charging stations in urban and suburban areas and locate them at places like grocery stores, you know, places where people are going anyway.
Right.
You know, in order to accommodate those people that can't charge at home, you know, and make it fast enough to charge so that, you know, you can do your driving. You go in, you do something you were going to do anyway. You don't have to go out of your way. That's the key, is not having to go out of your way and not sitting there in your car for an hour waiting for it to charge. You know, you go to the grocery store, you plug in the car, you go in, do your shopping for the week, and you come out 20 or 30 minutes later and your car's charged up.
Right.
And then you drive home. You know, so even if you don't have access to charging at home, you're not going around looking for a charging station. It's there where you want to be.
Right.
So, you know, those are the kinds of things. And then, you know, in the case of what Ford's doing with Ford Pass, you know, aggregating multiple charging networks, you know, to, again, trying to make it as seamless and reducing the friction in the ownership experience. So, you know, these are the kinds of things they need to do, and we just need more of it.
Yes, I agree completely.
Yeah. All right. Next up, something not electric.
Oh, should we stay on electric though and talk about Hyundai's?
Okay, let's do that then. Let's stay
just
with
for
that.
Seamless.
All right. So Hyundai, we're recording this on Monday morning. Hyundai put out a press release last night that they are creating a new brand called IONIQ, and details on this are a little bit sketchy at the moment. In fact, let me just check and see if sorry about that. I just want to see if I got an email response back from Hyundai on a question I had, and I'm not seeing anything yet. So what they announced was, you know, currently there's a car called the Hyundai IONIQ, which they launched a few years ago, which is a compact hatchback. It's on the same platform as the Kia Niro, and, you know, it's designed to be electrified across the board, not electric, but electrified. So there's three variants of the IONIQ. There's a hybrid, a plug-in hybrid, and a battery electric version. And the battery electric version currently gets 170 miles of range. Unfortunately for, you know, for Hyundai, you know, it's a car in a form factor, you know, a compact hatchback, you know, kind of similar shape, but, you know, a lot less weird looking than a Prius, that is out of fashion today. And, you know, it's done okay, but it hasn't been a huge seller. But, you know, that's been their brand for electrified vehicles. Now Hyundai is going to have a distinct brand. And what's not clear is, when they say distinct brand, is this going to be a standalone brand like Genesis or Polestar for Volvo that is electric only? And that's what IONIQ is going to be. It's going to be electric cars going forward, electric vehicles, cars and crossovers. Or is this going to be a sub-brand? You know, so are they going to be called Hyundais, or are they just going to be called IONIQs and IONIQ 5, IONIQ 6, IONIQ 7? Or are they going to be Hyundai IONIQs, you know, where, you know, it's more like Volkswagen and their ID3 or ID electric vehicles, ID3, ID4, and so on. What do you think about all this?
So I'm just looking at some of the stories that are out about it. They're calling it the IONIQ sub brand, but then in the next sentence it says that means IONIQ could become much like to Hyundai what Polestar is to Volvo. So I agree with you. I think it's unclear. My issue with this is it plays into what I just spoke about before, about it reinforces that these things are weird and different. And that is the only thing I don't like. It reminds me of the Audi e-tron, which I love that car, and I want it to be the Q6. I don't want it to be weird. I don't want it to have a weird name, a different name. I want it to be seamlessly integrated into the showroom where it's sits side by side with internal combustion engines, that this is just an alternative powertrain, an alternative power source for a consumer. It's not a different, weird thing. I don't know. I just, that was my first reaction, was that the amount of money that needs to go into educating consumers on the familiarity of the Ioniq brand when they already have a familiar brand in Hyundai. Everyone already knows Hyundai. They don't always know how to pronounce it. It's like Sunday, but they know that it exists, and the awareness level of the Hyundai brand is I would imagine pretty high.
So as you're speaking, I did get an email from Brandon Ramirez at Hyundai PR. I confirmed that they will be sold through Hyundai dealers. It'll be the Hyundai Ioniq 5, Ioniq 6. Ioniq 5 is the first one crossover that's coming in the fall of 2021. So it's, they're thinking of it more like their N brand.
Okay. I still am not a fan, because I feel like if we are going to push onto the consumer that these vehicles are good, if not better than internal combustion engines, they can't be weird. Mm-hmm. They can't be this special thing, this different thing. I would rather, from a strategic standpoint, I would rather just have it be presented as an alternative, like diesel is to gasoline, or, you know, that kind of, you know, a USB versus a USB-C. I don't understand the need to isolate these vehicles. Because I think it's isolating. I don't think it's elevating them. I think it's just isolating them. And the amount of money that will go into even promoting this Ioniq sub-brand, it's like Volvo with Polestar. Volvo is a really good name that everybody knows. Why isolate these vehicles into a separate compartment? I don't get that.
Well, and, you know, for Volvo in particular, you know, they're also going to have battery electric Volvos. You know, it's not like the Polestar is going to be the only one with electric vehicles. You know, in this case here, you know, what Hyundai's doing sounds almost the same as what Toyota tried to do, you know, in the late 2000s when they decided we're going to make Prius. Yes. Prius is still popular. We're going to make it a separate sub brand, you know, family. And they launched the Prius V and the Prius C, you know, and, you know, by the time those cars came out, you know, they had a few years where they did okay. But, you know, at that point, hybrids in general were becoming more mainstream, and you could get hybrid variants of pretty much everything in the Toyota lineup. And, you know, today, you know, the Prius V and C are gone. The regular Prius, you know, is declining in sales year over year. And the most popular hybrid Toyota is the RAV4.
Right.
You know, so why you would do this instead of just, you know, integrating it more cleanly into the Hyundai lineup doesn't quite make sense to me. I'm not sure that this is a good idea.
I agree completely. And it's interesting because we hadn't talked about this at all beforehand. And so, but I think that we're very much on the same page that it's, I feel like the marketing dollars that need to go into educating consumers and increasing brand awareness for Hyundai Ioniq 5, 6, 7 is just, I think it's money that could be spent elsewhere, you know?
Well, especially given that, you know, when Toyota did the Prius family, you know, it's like everybody knew what a Prius was.
Yes, right.
Time, yeah. 2007, 2008. Prius was, you know, it wasn't the biggest selling vehicle in the world, but it was pretty, I mean, it was doing 250,000,
right?
250,000 a year.
Yeah.
And even people that didn't own a Prius knew what a Prius was.
Right.
Whereas today, Hyundai's selling, you know, maybe 25,000 Ioniqs a year. Nobody knows what an Ioniq is unless you happen to have been in a Hyundai dealer. You know, I've never seen any marketing for the Ioniq. You know, I like it. It's a nice car, but you know, nobody knows what it is.
I think we need to live in California to see the marketing.
That's probably true. Although they do sell the hybrid nationally. The plug-ins are only sold in ZEV states.
They're probably focusing their marketing dollars in California.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that's sort of, you know, and again, my whole thing is just, we can't expect a consumer to consider an EV if we keep making them weird, if we keep isolating them, we keep putting them in a separate area, or these are, you know, these are the different ones. No, you put them all in the same showroom. You walk around, oh, this one's electric, this one's gas, this one's diesel, this is a P8, and you give them, it makes them more familiar. It keeps them all at the same level. You're just giving a consumer a choice. It's like, you know, like when you go shopping for ground beef and it'll say 80, 20, 15, you know, 15, 85, different levels of fat. Mm-hmm. They don't have them in, you know, you don't have to go over to the separate section. They're all together. You pick which one suits your dietary needs best. Let's just do that with these mobility, these powertrains, this, you know, how you get from A to B. I feel like we need to stop making these things different.
And, you know, Audi, for example, you know, when I spoke to them at the LA Auto Show last fall, we talked about e-tron, and, you know, the way they described it, you know, because when they first started when they first introduced the e-tron, the original e-tron, you know, they were referring to it as the e-tron Quattro, and then eventually just dropped that and just made it just e-tron. And the way they describe it now is that the original e-tron, they're, you know, sort of like the Quattro, you know, it's the e-tron, and e-tron is just going to be the suffix that they add to their plug-in vehicles going forward. So you're going to have like the Q4 e-tron, which is going to be the battery electric e-tron, and various other models as they go forward, just like they've done with Quattro. You know, originally Quattro was a single standalone model. Now Quattro refers to all-wheel drive Audis.
Right.
E-tron is going to, that's going to be what tells you that, you know, the Q4, the Q7, or whatever it is, has a plug. Yeah, and
right.
that's how they're moving forward with that. So, you know, maybe that's what Hyundai does, you know, something like that. I don't know. But I agree. I don't think that this is necessarily the right approach. And I think that this might be a waste of resources.
Yes. Yeah, that's the main thing to me, is that is this the best use of resources at this time for consumers? And I'm not there either.
Okay. Well, speaking of resources, Mr. Gordon Murray, always one of, you know, from the time I was a kid, when I first started following Formula One in the 1970s, his work, you know, he was the technical director, chief designer at Brabham back then, Brabham Formula One. And he created some of the most amazing Formula One cars. You know, today you look at F1 cars and they all pretty much look the same. You know, when you looked at F1 cars in the 70s and early 80s, you could always tell the one that probably came from Gordon Murray. You know, his mind works in a different way. You know, he had the BT46B fan car, which was unbelievable. And, you know, there was it the BT55, I think, was the one. You know, they were using a turbocharged 4-cylinder BMW engine that he wanted to lower the center of gravity. You know, when they first started using that engine, you know, like most 4-cylinders, it stood upright, you know, perpendicular to the ground. He said, why can't we tilt it over on its side and run it that way so we get a lower center of gravity? And so BMW built a new engine block for it and tilted it over like 80 degrees off vertical. And you know, all kinds of wild stuff. And then he got out of Formula One and started doing road cars. And he created something called the McLaren F1.
Just a which, little car.
Yeah.
It's a small thing.
I mean, they only sold 106 of them. You know, so
not iconic,
you know,
at all.
No. You know, which was, I think, you know, up until last week, probably the my favorite supercar of all time. Mm. You know, if I had a choice between a Bugatti and an F1, you know, or any contemporary McLaren for that matter, I would take the F1 in a heartbeat. You know, three-seater, driver in the middle, that BMW V12 engine. In the early 90s, in like 93, 94, I spent some time over in England. The company I was working for at the time, Kelsey Hayes, we were doing ABS and traction control development at a test track in England near Coventry called Myra. And, you know, it was a track that was used by a lot of different companies in that area, including McLaren. And, you know, before the McLaren, the F1 went into production, we got, you know, for several months, we were seeing them out there, you know, 2-3 times a week. You know, and I got a chance one day by the control tower, you know, there while the driver was inside checking in, you know, it was sitting there with the engine cover open and I'm checking this thing out. It was amazing getting to see this thing up close.
And that was before cell phones, so you couldn't take photos.
That's right.
Stuff, right?
Well, even if I had taken a picture, you know, I mean, I would have been thrown arrested. Out of the facility. Yeah. They would have stomped my phone into dust and thrown me out. So, you know, couldn't do that sort of thing. But, you know, it was an amazing sight to see. And this car was so tiny. And Gordon Murray's done a new vehicle called the T50.
It's stunning.
Yeah. It's amazing. And, you know, he said, you know, he's got nothing against electric vehicles, but, you know, he wanted to do, you know, the ultimate analog supercar. You know, so there's no electrification on this thing. You know, it's got a 4-liter bespoke V12 engine developed by Cosworth that revs to 12,100 RPM, makes 660 horsepower. This car, you know, one of the things that Murray's always focused on is lightweight. You know, the F1, you know, you look at a Bugatti, you know, weighs about 3,500 pounds. You know, the F1 was just over 2,200 pounds. This one is actually 986 kilos, or about 2,178 pounds, with 660 horsepower. It's unreal. What do you think of it?
I think it's stunning. I mean, it's just, and you put it perfectly. It is a true analog car, just about the driving experience. I mean, the way that it opens up, it's this huge front hood, and that's how you actually get into the car. It looks like a rocket ship from the back. It's stunningly, stunningly gorgeous. You know, I don't spend nearly enough time in supercars, but I did get a chance to drive the Bugatti, right? I did get a chance to drive the Bugatti Chiron, and that was an incredible experience. I mean, this thing is, you know, it's for 100 people. They're making 100 of them. And I will say that when you think about these, you know, having recently met a couple of people that are both collectors, but users of and drivers of these supercars, I think that those 100 people are, you know, will appreciate them. I mean, when you only have to pick 100 people, you're going to get people that get it, that look and say, you know, this is what driving is about. And, you know, it's funny. I think about sometimes, like I complain a lot about infotainment systems and things like that, but, you know, in Bugatti's world, they actually preferred to keep that stuff all to a minimum because it also ages the vehicle. You can tell when that vehicle came out. When you look at something like the T50, your only responsibility in that car is to drive it. That's it. It's not about
connecting. It even has a manual transmission.
Yeah, it even has a manual transmission. It's not about connecting with the outside world. It's actually about connecting with this incredible machine that is fully dependent upon you to execute properly on it. And we, when you think about self-driving cars and all those sensors and everything that I'm a fan of, this is not that. Mm-hmm. And that's really cool. I love that.
You know, the funny thing about the F1, when they were originally planning it, you know, today, I mean, you know, it's this iconic machine that, you know, everybody wants, you know, they go at auction. I think the last one that sold at auction went for something like $18 million. And, you know, the F1 was one of the first road cars to be priced at $1 million. And the original plan was for a production run of 300 cars. It sold so poorly, even after it won overall at the 1995 24 Hours of Le Mans, they could not sell those things. People didn't understand. You know, it's like, why would I want this? You know, nobody wanted them. And so they actually cut production short after only 106 cars, of which about 25 of them were race cars. You know, so there was only about 75, fewer than 80 road cars, F1 road cars, which, you know, when you think about that today is mind-boggling that, you know, people, you know, wealthy people, you know, almost fight over the opportunity to buy, you know, limited production Ferraris and Lamborghinis and Bugattis, and McLaren couldn't, you know, McLaren, a brand that had won so many F1 championships and so many races, you know, could not sell 300 cars, 300 road cars. In
1995, it was a very, very different world. It was, mm-hmm. you know, the tech world was only just starting. And, you know, so I was thinking about, you know, having grown up in an area that's pretty, very fortunate, pretty wealthy. I remember when my neighbor down the street, he created a product that we all use every day, and he sold it for tens of millions of dollars. He didn't move, which was always amazing to me. But they had one of the first VCRs, and they also had a Sony Betamax, and this was in the 80s. And, you know, I remember, and they had a collection of cars. It's why I could identify the exhaust note of a Ferrari by the time I was 12 years old, because we lived on a cul-de-sac and they lived at the end, and they would go back and forth with these exotics that were unbelievable. And I would lay in my bed, because they would sometimes leave early in the morning. I'd lay in my bed or be in my bedroom that overlooked our road. And I'd be like, okay, which one is that? And then I'd be able to look outside and identify them. But, you know, it was the idea, you know, when you think back of wealthy people back then, it was a different world. They didn't, you know, the fact that these people, they spent so much of their money on cars was seen as almost lowbrow. You know, like, why didn't they invest in a yacht or, you know, three or four homes? Like, that was, you know, not to say that people didn't have exotics, but, you know, it's just sort of funny. The mentality, I think, was different then. And now some of the people that have famous car collections, you know, Jay Leno and, you know, the tech people out in Seattle that go to exotics at Redmond Town Center every week, which is the largest weekly collection of cars and coffee for exotics in the country. And we think that's probably the world. It's, you know, it's a different mentality. Those guys are all now in their 40s, they're in their 50s, 60s, 70s. That's, you know, the guys that started something like that are in their late 50s, and 30, 40 years ago, you know, 30 years ago, they didn't have money to spend on these kinds of cars. So I think it's, you know, it's just the market is different now.
Yeah. Well, hopefully Mr. Murray will be able to sell all 100 of these T50s. I don't think you'll have any problem selling them this time.
I don't think he will either.
Yeah. All right. Well, with that, why don't we wrap it up for this week?
And, all right. Sounds good.
Yeah. I don't think we need to talk about Maserati Trofeo. There's not really much to say there.
Maserati's got V8 engines. That's it. That's what I took away.
Yeah. V8 engines in the Ghibli. Okay.
In the Ghibli. Yeah, that's it.
All right. Thank you, Rebecca.
Thank you, Sam.
Bye.
Bye.